Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich.
How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is completely self-funded, produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. Consider making a small donation to support the podcast. Go to bit.ly/support, capital G, capital T, and podcast. I repeat, bit.ly/supportgtpodcast. Thank you so much. And for more information, please visit Natalie's website, join the podcast Instagram page, and subscribe to the newsletter to receive updates on future episodes. So for today's episode, I have here Emma. And Emma and I, we met through email. So Emma reached out to me because of my podcast, and she listened to some of the episodes and shared with me about her losses. And something in her email sort of touched me, and I was interested in a little bit more. And I answer all of the questions that I get, all the contact emails that I get through the podcast or anyway. And I reached out to Emma, and something in me, and that's always how I choose my guest, is okay, this might be an interesting person to be speaking on the podcast and sharing her story. So I asked her if she would be willing to share her story to the podcast for all of us to listen. And so this is where we are today. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So just to give you a little bit of background about Emma. So Emma is a Brit who has been living in France, just outside Geneva, for the past 25 years. She grew up in Brussels in the 70s and 80s and then headed to the UK for university studies, specializing in organizational psychology, a field she loves and works in as an independent practitioner. Between 2015 and 19, Emma had a series of significant losses, four in fact, starting with her male best friend, Don, then her youngest brother, Edward, then her husband, Mike, and then their youngest child, Julia. It's been a lot. It's been too much. And yet the world keeps spinning and somehow life carries on. There's so much to live for and enjoy. And most of it, much to enjoy about life, but Emma still has her two surviving children, which are now young adults. There's also a lovely new man in her life that goes by the name of Majul, like the dates. And she might tell a little story about that. And at the time of writing this, she still has both of her parents now in her mid-80s. So welcome, Emma. It's so nice to have you on the podcast.
Oh, likewise. Thank you very much, Natalie.
How are you today?
So I actually answer that question, how are you in this moment? And in this moment, I feel like a lot of energy is bubbling up in me through my heart, through my arms. And I'm actually feeling quite tender as I hear you reread what sounds like biographical details. Mm-hmm. It's not your average biography. And I feel like if I heard that about someone else's life, it would be show-stopping. Mm-hmm. And yet in the next sentence I say, life carries on. And I... Most moments of most days, I feel that parallel track, or not intertwining, not even parallel, intertwining track of just carrying all of these losses and alongside it, a massive desire to live, a massive desire not only to live, but to enjoy life.
So why don't we pull out this accordion of this biography, pull it out a little bit, and why don't you tell the listener a little bit about your story of loss and trauma and how it has informed you?
Yeah, and I always want to start with my friend Don, because Don was, for me at least, a unique friendship. I know many people, at least of my age, I'm in my mid-50s, who found it hard to keep male friends as and when they moved into committed relationships with other people. And Don was the one man I could do that with. And we met at university. I was 18, and I knew him for just a few months shy of 30 years. And just always simple, lovely, great friends. We'd have weekends together. We'd go off together. And I realized with hindsight how much of that was enabled by his wife and how much of that was enabled by my husband.
Mm-hmm.
Because we met each other before we met our significant others, and yet they embraced the friendship that we had. And so when he died, I felt I'd lost my one sole male friend.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had other male friends, but they were the husbands of friends. They weren't my friends. But at the time of his dying in September 2015, my younger brother Edward was end of life, or moving towards end of life, with a serious brain tumor. And he'd been diagnosed with that about 2.5 years prior, and he'd had 2 operations. And for a variety of reasons, he moved to near me for his health care, and he was away from his family. And my younger sister and I and my parents were very involved in caring for him. And he ended up in a hospice in Geneva, which I now volunteer for, and I've done quite a bit of pro bono work for. But I really feel like I was with him, very closely with him, for the last 6 or 7 months of his life.
Yeah.
And so I lost a best friend and I lost my youngest brother within 4 months. And I think I was just starting to emerge from all of that. You know, I was still working. I was still living. I felt the loss of him, but it wasn't debilitating for neither of them in a way. And that's not to undermine them at all. But just when I contrast with what came next then, not even a year and a bit later, so about 8 months after my brother's death, my husband felt a tug in his side, and it didn't go away. First he put it down to some work that he'd done on my car. Didn't go away, and eventually went to the doctor, and long story short, pancreatic cancer. Chemo, a few months, but just so rapid. And by, I would say, early 2017, well, Christmas 2016-17, he was already very, very ill. And he died in the same hospice that my brother died in and that I had already been working in. So the hospice has been a huge red thread. And at the time, our kids were Julia just 13, Megan, 15, going on 16, and Ben, 17, going on 18, massively critical school times for the older two in particular.
Hmm. But also significant in their upbringing, in their early adolescence.
Of course. And I have so many theories about Julia, because I think girls and mums are tricky. I think adolescent girls and mums can be very, very tricky. And I think both Megan and Julia had a strong, strong, strong allegiance with their father.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my son, Ben, I think was much more even keeled with both parents. But I think 13 to 16 is an age where girls really need their dads. And I don't know. I don't know what happened with Julia and why she ended up taking her life 2 years later.
So quite early, when you say when she was 13, so she was only 15.
She was 15. She was 15 and 3 months to the day.
Mm-hmm.
And she hanged herself.
Yeah.
Where we had scattered my husband's ashes. Close to home, a place where we all walked, where I walk the dog still to this day.
So quite a symbolic place when you describe it like that.
I have no doubt that it was connected to her father's death. I have no doubt, and this may be self-protection, you know, I've done plenty of self-questioning. Would she have taken her life if her dad hadn't died? I mean, the 99.999% of me is convinced that she'd be alive today if her dad hadn't died. And I can't ever know that for certain.
Yeah.
Because she spiraled into depression. She was in and out of hospital, lots of emergency visits, therapy support, psychiatric units, daytime, week long. And as you know, we know the pattern, right? Someone seems to be getting better, more energy. They come home for the weekend and boom.
So there was a long lead up of hospital, you mentioned, and mental health.
Yeah. I have some of my writing to go on to know what happened when, and sometimes it surprises me to read, oh gosh, things were really not good here at this point. I had thought things spiraled later. You know, time goes like this, right? After grief and loss, you don't know what happens when. I mean, I know I get the order of things muddled up, but sometimes my writing will say, oh gosh, this happened before. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And as you know, and most of my listeners will know, my mother died from suicide just 4.5 months after my daughter died. So we have a commonality and experience of suicide, and obviously the questions that go with it in your hair, but also the questions that people ask us or don't ask us. And we had a little bit of a conversation prior to recording, so I want to bring it in here because we had this interesting understanding about what to ask and what not to ask, or where, or what happens with a question that people ask. And maybe we want to talk about this here a little bit, because one of the things that happened in my case was my mother died, and then we were still living in Sydney. We came here and I was staying with my young daughter, my husband, and my father. And, you know, people come and go. Some don't ask a question, some others do. And my father just really had this opening in him where he wanted to talk about everything to everyone. And I just said to him, you need to remember that whatever you say, people can't unsee, unimagine, or unthink. So the details that you give, because he found my mother, will stay with people. So even though I didn't want to hold him back from telling people, he was at that moment, he was in a way, he wanted to tell everyone. But tell us a little bit about your personal situation. And we obviously also had two of Julia's siblings who were also dealing with the loss of their father and also dealing now with the loss of their sister.
Yeah, and the loss of their uncle before that.
Yeah.
So my eldest child was at home at the time. So it was June 2019. I'm just trying to think what stage of education he would have been at. He must have been at the beginning of a summer holiday in his undergraduate year, one of his undergraduate years. I forget the details of how long he'd been at home, but he'd been at home long enough for him to see what was going on with his sister. And I had been out for the evening. There was always somebody at home with my daughter. This is pre-COVID, but I had a series of pet sitters living with me for a period of, I think it started a couple of years after it must have started a year after my husband died, just to enable my life, right? Because you suddenly go from six people in the house looking after a dog to one person looking after a dog. And I, you know, work and so on. I had to be able to have somebody. So I chose to have pet sitters. And the woman I had, I was always very careful in who I chose and was upfront. The woman I had was a former psychiatric nurse. And she agreed, and there was some compensation involved, but she agreed to, you know, be really super vigilant when I did go out. And I wasn't going out much or far, but I was out that evening. And I had a message from the father of one of my daughter's best friends. And he forwarded me a text. And maybe this is where I can't say here what the exact words were, but it made pretty clear that she was trying to take her life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rushed home and, well, I called my son and he was calling her. And again, I almost forget the details, but this is what the shock does. You really lose your memory, lose your mind. Called the police. The police were trying to locate her phone, contacting friends. I got home and it was about 10 p.m., something like that, 11 p.m. And eventually one of, and you know, at that point of the night where you no longer dare call friends, they were all about to be doing some important school exams. And one friend, another friend sent me, I think it's Snapchat, where you can see where your friends are.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me a screen. I think, I can't remember which app it is, but there's one where you can see where your friends are. You geolocalize them. And he sent me a screenshot. And I realized exactly where she was. And I think I knew then. I think I knew then that she was taking her life. And why she was there, where we had scattered Mike's ashes. And so my son was there. He knew everything that was going on. And as we were together sitting at the table with my pet sitter, Lee, I said to him, this could be it, you know. And he said, yes, I know. And so there was this very calm sense of, this is now what we're up against. This is now going to be moving into our new life. It felt like the, you know, how they talk about the eye of the hurricane. I felt like this is our last piece of calm. This is our last moment of calm. It may all be fine and nothing, and I'll forget this moment of calm, or I may have to remember this was the last moment of calm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even getting to answering the questions about what I answer. I feel like I answer people's questions when I sense that they come from a place of genuine love. So not curiosity nosiness, but curiosity, help me understand you, Emma. Help me understand the world you live in. Help me understand your life. And you'll cut me in any time that you think I'm going off on too much of a tangent. But moving perhaps to Mike. So before Julia really spiraled, I was out on a walk with a woman who I had understood also lost her husband. She reached out to me. She was an important figure in the school that my children went to. And as and when I communicated with the school to say, look, the father, these children's father is seriously ill. Please have that on your radar. I don't know what's going to be going on. We don't know yet. And she wrote back to me saying, Emma, I just would like you to know that I've seen your message. I'm really, really sorry. I also lost my husband when my kids were at the exact same stage. Anyway, so I knew who this woman was. We developed a friendship. Some weeks after my husband's death, we were walking. And she asked me this most beautiful question, which was simply, I'm wondering what you're willing to share about your husband's last day.
Nice.
And I've always remembered that question. And I remember it washing over me like a warm balm. Because in that question was curiosity, yes. Yes, phrased a different way, it could seem nosiness. But she unfolded a story that I realized later, I need to remember this. There's so much in this last day. You know, there's like 3 days worth in this last day. I later wrote about it. And so I've got now a record of so much of what I remember of my husband's last day, which was viciously hard and also beautiful. So that's one question. So the questions that work for me are the ones that invite me with permission
exactly.
to share what I want to share, open enough that I can take that question where I want to take it. And clearly with the, you know, I'm curious about what you're willing to share of. That's the language.
Mm. And it implies this willingness. So you have a choice, and whatever you share is what you're willing or able in this very moment to share and to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as and when I then experience the loss of my daughter, and this is a whole other topic, you know, friendships just disappeared. I did become everyone's worst enemy.
Say a little bit more about that.
Everyone's worst enemy. Everyone's worst, not everyone's worst enemy. I became everyone's, you know, worst nightmare. That's the language I wanted. I became everyone's worst nightmare. To lose a spouse, one thing. To lose a spouse and a child.
Hmm. Speechlessness.
And I would carry on trying to see some of my local friends, go out with my dog, go on walks. And so, so quickly I realized, oh my God, they're not asking me anything about how I am. They're not asking me a single question about how I am, really. You know, even though I hate that question, how are you, really? Please, I mean, just ask me something. And so then I offered this question to people. I said, ask me this. So one question was, one friend was brave enough to say, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to ask you. And I said, here's a question. Where are Mike and Julia in your life today?
That's nice. Yeah.
And she actually still never asked me that question. And our friendship has ended. It actually has ended. But I offer that question to other people to ask me. But, you know, because some years have passed now, I can actually function pretty much more or less most days in polite society. But when other people come to me and say, oh, my, this person I know, I'm going to see them. I haven't seen them for 3 years, but in this time, I've learned their daughter has died. What do I do? What do I say? I sometimes say, you know, here's a question I always wished I'd been asked. And so I give it to them gently, and I say, you know, this might help, you know, come at it with curiosity, come at it with love, come at it with permission. But those who've been brave enough to ask the question, and then I say, so, you know, did you ask that question? What happened? They do say, you know, actually it opened up a lovely conversation, and they took it wherever they wanted. So for me, it's about the permission. It's about the recognition that they're still in my life today, not in a physical present way that I would like, but clearly they're just part of my, I don't know, my energetic circle or whatever. They're part of my every moment, consciously, more consciously, less consciously. But
you know, I remember now that you're talking about what people can ask. I remember now, and I forgot before, that part of my latest book, Bridging the Grief Gap, I actually asked people, what do people say and how does it affect you? And I had situations where they described which were difficult for them and others which were meaningful or helpful for them. So I have a whole list of those. And interestingly, for example, the question of how are you, or whether people should say, I'm sorry, evokes completely different reaction in different people. So I think one thing that I would add is the permission to say something that is here, and the permission for the other person to respond in whatever way they do. Because a person who grieves and another person who grieves, they respond to the same question very differently. So even if you say, I'm really sorry, some person has had enough of that sentence. And some person says, at least you say something. So to even embrace the potential that it's different and doesn't have to be the same every day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big swirling river, really. It's constantly moving, constantly changing. In fact, more like an eddy, perhaps, that turns around a little bit. Powerful current of water that's, you know, it's not linear at all. I'm not further downstream. I can go right back.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things is that in my experience, after a certain amount of years, people stop asking. And I think it's the natural flow of life that new things come in, and also that more life has happened since then, which is okay too. But recently, it was just in the week of my mother's death anniversary, and I was driving with my father, and I was dropping him off. And because I had the dates in mind, and we came to a stop, and I said, I can either drop you here on the station on the right, or we can go to the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him a choice, because he doesn't talk about my mother mm-hmm. without me prompting, usually.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, oh yeah, let's go to the cemetery. And I was surprised, but mm-hmm. yeah. And on that short drive from where I asked him and where he had made the choice to the cemetery, it was only a short drive, he started sharing about certain things that are still happening to me, like he has still flashbacks. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't surprised, but I'm sure that given the circumstances, someone would like to share about something, not necessarily about the death or the flashbacks, maybe even about, as you said, what are the memories that you have of Julia that you mm-hmm. would like to share? Because mm-hmm. so much is overpowered by this trauma often, because yeah. it is huge. And yeah. then there's still those other memories that we have. And yeah, I guess some people might also react in different ways to questions or no questions, but there's ways that if there is an opening, and in this story with my dad, there was this opening just in terms of the decision he took and then the place we went to for mm-hmm. him to say something. I didn't ask him, he shared willingly about his own situation. So I guess,
yeah.
you know, I wonder about that. I mean, in your case, it is between 9 and 7 years ago that your significant losses, the 4 in a series, happened. How is that for you? Like, what resources have helped you in the passing of the time?
Lots, lots and lots. No, my daughter died only 4.5 years ago.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, so it's a bit more recent than that. But before I talk about resources, one of the things that has been, so friendships has been a big theme for me. I've lost many, many friendships, and some of the ones that were the deepest, even though they sort of disappeared for a while, are coming back. And those are the ones where stories happen, because these are often people who've known me a long time, who've mm-hmm. known my daughter since she was born, who've known Mike. I met Mike when I was 20. People I've known, you know, for all of that time. And they come out with their own stories, which is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an interesting dynamic sometimes of, as more time passes, I meet more people who didn't know them, didn't know any of my loved dead ones. And so they may or may not ask me questions, and I may or may share different things. Or I may connect with them and develop a relationship more strongly because of the connection around grief and loss. So there's some beauty there. But then there are the stories that I hear from friends about the time that Julia did this. And I may have been there, but I've forgotten it. Or it may have marked them in a different way than it marked me. Or things about that happened at the funeral. I mean, that funeral, I was present and I was not present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just last week, 2 weeks ago, a really dear friend came to stay, and she said, Emma, I'm going to write up some stories about Julia. I mean, that's a huge gift.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to have, not just for me to feel like I'm the holder of stories. Anyway, to come back to your question about what's helped, writing. Writing, 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 writing. Having a space to write, joining writing programs, grief writing programs, facilitating grief writing, meeting people who'd had similar losses. And then I like to mention Enneagram. I don't know if you're familiar with Enneagram, but I came across Enneagram 15 years ago, so a long, long time before any losses. And is it Enneagram? No, it's not Enneagram, but it's self-knowledge, self-awareness. So horrifying as it is to find out your Enneagram type, you can start to do a lot of good inner work. And so I know that being 50 when my husband died was very different to if I'd been 30.
Yeah.
Because here's one of the things that happened, and I do tell this story with great confidence. So my Enneagram type is type 7 for people who understand Enneagram. It's a huge natural joie de vivre and I think capacity to love life, looks for the good stuff, and when not very developed can be completely scatty and run around and consume and, you know, look away from everything that hurts. But because I was seeing that, I started to learn, oh gosh, that is what I'm doing. And I was working on all of that for a number of years. And so as and when, you know, let's say Mike died, the third loss, I thought, okay, what are you likely to do if you didn't stay aware? Oh, I could fall down a wine bottle. I could consume films. You know, I could just stay busy. Okay, you're going to have to learn to be with this. And so learning to face into it was huge. But here's one of the things that happened, and this is the point of my story. At Mike's funeral, which was only 4 or 5 days after he died, at the ceremony. So after the ceremony, we had some drinks and food and so on. Beautiful April day. I can't remember the moment. I can't remember what prompted it, but I laughed out loud. I laughed out loud. And in that moment, right after that, and I hope I can use F words on your program, I thought, thank fucking God my joy is intact. Now, I've met so many people who've had a very close-in loss who say, oh my God, who am I to be laughing?
Yeah.
I must be a horrible person.
Exactly.
And I just thought, okay, my joy is there. Okay, it's going to come and go, but it will be there. It will survive. It will see me through this. It's not going to compensate, but it's going to accompany. And I had this very early on, I had this very clear sense of, okay, these are strands and, you know, a plait, a metaphor, or I had the sense of grief and love and or grief and joy just wrapping around each other. And I didn't know which one was in or which one was out. It didn't matter. But I just had this strong conviction. The very, very core of who I am, the core of my strengths, the core of my essence, the core of my what brings me joy is going to be okay.
And you mentioned before we started recording about having listened to Turiya's episode, and she mentioned one of that, that certain people lose the connection to a part of their essence, which is joy, the yellow essence of the Latif, and they lose the connection in a significant loss. And it's so often the case that people actually feel guilt towards experience joy after loss, because it's as if grief and loss cannot coexist.
Yeah.
But one thing I learned is that after a significant loss, I experienced a lot of contradictory emotional, contradictory states at the same time. Like, especially in my case where I had a girl, a baby, and I was first time mother. So I had the joys of that and all the things about that, but also the grief of her sister. And these lived simultaneously, sometimes side by side, all in one moment. That's very confusing for either or person, which we and our mind generally is geared to think it's either good or bad. Mm. But it's those things that happen, like grief and joy, that coexist.
Yeah, and I can't remember where I read this, but early on, I was able to see that grief encompassed feelings of love. And I'm not talking about the, you know, grief is loving a dead person, which is, you know, one of the definitions, which I think is a good definition. Grief is loving a dead person. But that the panoply of grief includes the joy that you had the person for as long as you did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bittersweetness. So I think bittersweet is a great word for grief as well, because it can encompass everything. Grief is not, I'm big on education. If we could educate people that grief is natural and that grief can encompass the riches that you receive from the relationship with that person, I don't think we would turn away quite so much. Yes, grief is heavy. Yes, grief hurts. Yes, grief is dark. It can be incredibly, incredibly debilitating. And if we also look at it encompassing the preciousness of still being alive and the preciousness of here's how I carry you with me, we might turn away a bit less.
Mm.
So they go side by side, alongside, integrated, both and. Can I say one more thing about what's helped?
Are we okay? Sure, sure.
So recently, in 2023, I started to come across people who were in my circle working at the end of life hospice and working with people who were dying, who were working with psychedelics. And so I thought, well, you know what, if they're doing this and they're quite grounded citizens, upright citizens, I could explore this. And so I did. So I've had a couple of MDMA experiences. And the person I was working with is very intentional about start with MDMA, because it is the big heart opener and it's the big compassion booster. And so I've had two very beautiful experiences where, you know, even if my cognitive brain doesn't always believe this, I've had moments of being able to just sit back during the experience of being under a very tiny dose, of being able to just witness my daughter and just have full acceptance for her decision, full acceptance that she is where she is, wherever that may be. I hope she's with her dad. And even if it's hard to hold on to those moments all the time, just that I had some moments of being, I'm really okay with your choice. I am really okay with your choice. Now, right now, here with you today, I kind of think, yeah, I wish you hadn't made that decision. But knowing I have really deeply felt, I'm okay with what you chose to do. And I'm glad you were with me as long as you could be. That makes a difference.
Mm. And they can coexist as well, as you mentioned, you know, like I, for myself, in respect to my mother's decision, I also have full acceptance. And I also miss her presence, especially in my life and in my daughter's life. It's still, again, like a parent contradiction, but it still can live, for me at least, at the same time. Yes, I accept. And I also, it's not acceptance, but it's, I really miss that presence in our ongoing life.
Yeah. And the acceptance is about not fighting with the world. So I certainly can't claim to be a Buddhist practitioner, but I am around enough people who are, and I've read enough really powerful material that just differentiates between pain and suffering. And one of the big pieces of that is don't add more suffering to the pain. The pain is there. And by pushing against and resisting and she should never have done this and why has all of this happened to me, that's just adding the suffering. And on a good day, and most days have a lot of good moments in them, I can fully be with that. I'm not resisting what's happened. I'm learning to live with what's happened. And I think that's an important section for me.
That is absolutely important. So before we round up with the rapid fire question, I still wanted to give some thoughts and minutes of your time, of our time, to talk about the specificness of your situation in terms of what we spoke before started recording. Yeah. So, and you alluded a little bit on the situation that first your male friend and then your brother died and then your husband and then your daughter. And so for some people, that was like the stop of being able to speak to you. And we talked about the specificness of grieving a child without your husband, being a widow grieving a child. And you mentioned community as a really important aspect of your situation. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, one of the things that's very difficult in grief is hearing people's advice to you when you're right at ground zero. Oh, you'll find that you look back on this with love, or you need to find community. It makes no sense early on. Find community. And yet over time, I realized there's this tiny little grain of truth in a lot of the platitudes. People should still be very careful about saying them. But so finding community has been important. It wasn't something I was capable of early on. But about 18 months after my husband died, so when I still had Julia, I joined the North American Soaring Spirits organization for a conference, a widow's conference, a three-day on-site in Toronto, Canada. And I met some people who've really stayed very close to my heart. There's a group of five of us, and we call ourselves the Morning Glories. As in morning. And they're hugely important. And yet when my daughter died, I felt them turn away. You know, most of them had kids. Most of them were just struggling with the day-to-day. And so then I thought, okay, if you can't be with me, then who can be? Okay, I'm going to go to child loss organizations. And then I went to a physical, this is pre-COVID, so I went to a UK event, and it was horrible. It was horrible for a couple of reasons. One, they kept on talking about child loss is the worst loss you can have. Well, I was reeling from my husband's loss. I was in shock with my daughter's loss, but I was really grieving my husband. So don't tell me that child loss is worst. Don't let's be ranking. I didn't like that framing. And then everyone there had their partners. And I felt really, really isolated. And so I thought, well, I need to create my own community of people who've lost a spouse and a child. But how do you find that? You know, there's a few books. And so I have met a few people, but not on my continent, which is Europe. And I'm finding, you know, if there are people listening here who've lost a spouse and a child or children, you know, how do we do this? How do we carry on living, losing a child, which is huge, huge, without a spouse? So that's what I'm still looking for. Just two people would be good.
So this is a call out to anyone listening here, because I know there's people out there who have, you can never find the same kind, exactly the same kind of loss. And even if someone is divorced, it's a different scenario than losing a husband through death. But, you know, it's like a call out to people that I know in the circles are there, not just in the world anywhere, but also in Europe or closer. So let's hope that you find the morning glories that also carry the love of a child that is no longer physical here.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Emma, for the time that you've given us and for sharing your story and your spirit in dealing with the series of those significant losses in your life. It's been a very beautiful conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for your loving questions.
So like with all of my guests, I finish with the rapid fire question. Shall we do that now?
Yeah.
So grieving and trauma means?
I've reflected a lot about this one. I think trauma is about disintegrating and disabling. And grieving, when conscious, is about reconnecting and being differently enabling.
And healing means?
Just bringing all of me into me, whole, fully.
And if this would be a video podcast, you would see her wrapping her arms around herself. It's beautiful. And what have you learned about yourself in the light of loss and trauma?
That I'm a writer.
And what would be one thing you wish people knew about loss and trauma?
That it's everywhere. That loss, the endings, that it's all around us and we need to turn towards.
And what would be one specific thing that has changed since your losses and trauma that you wouldn't want to miss?
I don't think I've become a better person, but I do think that I am more present to impermanence and the hardship of the world and the planet.
Well, thank you so much, Emma. It's been a great pleasure to meeting you in this way.
You too. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimmelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30-minute free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.